Support for PrePublic is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the recipients of the 2024 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2024 Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
Welcome to this Wednesday and rather warm edition of Main Street here in North Dakota. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, the New York Kammermusiker returns for its 17th annual North Dakota Winds of Change concerts, and we'll visit with Ilana Peterson to get the latest on where they'll be in this North Dakota tradition. Also, Rick Gion tells us what his go-to food choices are at North Dakota street fairs. That's on the newest edition of Prairie Plates. But first, we visit with North Dakota's Supreme Court Chief Justice John Jensen. Our discussion covers the judicial system, the rule of law, the importance of trusting our independent judicial branch, and what the Chief Justice's concerns are relative to the way North Dakota elects its Supreme Court justices. Mr. Chief Justice, welcome to Main Street.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Our nation is a nation of laws administered by the rule of law, and our goal today is to talk about that, and specifically about North Dakota's courts, how we should perceive the courts here in our state. Should we believe that they are an independent judicial branch of government, free from any outside influence or outside irregular influence? So I want to ask you, Mr. Chief Justice, as we begin today, how do you ensure the impartiality of judges in North Dakota's judicial system?
One of the things that people might not realize is North Dakota has a very thorough, very detailed judicial conduct code. And the judicial conduct code encompasses just about everything from what judges can say about pending cases, which really isn't much, what contact judges can have through ex parte communications, that is, people outside the court system. It defines even what activities they can be involved in outside of their judicial responsibilities. And we have a judicial conduct commission that then applies those rules and operates very much like an attorney discipline system. There's an individual attorney, and her office is in charge of any complaints that are filed, investigating those complaints, and then following up on those complaints. And the sanctions can vary anywhere from a removal of the judge or a request for the judge to retire if it is something unrelated to improper conduct, but related maybe to a physical health issue, all the way down to just a reprimand and a whole host of things in between. And fortunately, we haven't had a lot of instances in which there have been suspensions or even removals, but there certainly has been some.
What is the makeup of the commission?
The commission is made up of seven individuals, and they are not part of the court system. They're separate from the court system and independent of the judicial branch, with the exception of ultimately their decision with regard to discipline can be appealed to the North Dakota Supreme Court. So if a judge were disciplined in some manner, didn't believe that the discipline that was imposed was appropriate, they could appeal it to the North Dakota Supreme Court.
What measures, digging a little bit deeper in this discussion about outside influence,
sure.
What measures are in place to protect judges and the courts from outside political influence?
Well, there are a number of measures. First off, with regard to the legislature, which is who controls the purse strings in every state and also in the federal government, judicial salaries can't be modified once somebody is sitting in office, or at least not decreased. They can be increased. But those judicial conduct rules and keeping the ex parte communications rules in place to keep individual judges from having conversations about cases outside of the judicial branch. But also, we have pretty detailed rules with regard to even campaigning, even individuals who are not yet judges, but campaigning for judicial positions are subject to our rules of judicial conduct, which prohibit them from essentially indicating how they're going to rule. Party endorsements are precluded. We also have nonpartisan elections, which I think is, it's certainly not unique.
We live in an era, Mr. Chief Justice, I think, where people have less respect, maybe, for our courts or the judiciary in general than they used to. What do you think about that in terms of here in North Dakota and our state's judiciary?
You know, I think we're fortunate in North Dakota, just the size of our state. It's really easy, actually, to interact with judges in our state. In fact, I was talking to one of my colleagues this morning, unrelated to a legal issue, but, you know, the county commissioner calls him up and talks about a road issue on some property that's adjoining his. It's really easy to have contact. We have 55 trial court judges in North Dakota and 5 Supreme Court judges. But beyond that, in North Dakota, I think our judiciary does a really good job of public access, and in a number of ways. In particular, we do a lot of school visits. Our district court judges do them locally. The Supreme Court holds sessions at various locations throughout the state several times a year. This past year, for example, we held a session at the University of North Dakota School of Law. We held sessions at 2 different high schools and then held a session at NDSU. That really allows us to at least the public to see what it is we do. And I think for the public to see, you know, how hard the judiciary works. And I don't know if I can expand a little bit further than that. My background, in addition to law, is accounting. I love statistics. So one of the things I like to do is look at data. And one of the things that I point to in North Dakota as what I believe is some evidence that we're doing a really good job with regard to concerns about bias, concerns about public opinion, or with regard to our appeals. Even though we only have 55 trial court judges in North Dakota, in any given year, we handle somewhere between 180 and 200,000 cases, and that's between new cases and cases that are reopened. And I think of appeals as instances in which a party to the litigation doesn't believe they were treated fairly or believes that the law was misapplied. And despite having that really voluminous caseload, that 180 to 200,000 cases a year, we only get 400 appeals. And that's a really, really small percentage. And in particular in North Dakota, where our legislature sets what can be appealed, and essentially every case in North Dakota can be appealed. There are a few exceptions, but just about every case can be appealed. And on top of that, the North Dakota Supreme Court doesn't have discretion. If somebody appeals, which just about everybody can, the North Dakota Supreme Court is required to decide that case. Unlike the U.S. Supreme Court and some other courts, we can't exercise discretion not to take the appeal. So again, when you look at those numbers, that's a really small number where people don't think they were treated fairly, or they think the law is misapplied. And then even when you look at the numbers even closer, about 80% of those cases are affirmed unanimously. So it's a very, very small number where we see maybe something, there could have been the perception of unfairness.
Are you worried about the noise we all hear nationally relative to courts and the judiciary maybe having an impact down the road here? And are you taking steps to concern yourself with that?
Yeah, it is a concern. And for example, you know, looking at a newspaper headline the other day about a decision of this court, and the headline is Supreme Court sides with. It's just the language that's being used is very much a concern to me. The court doesn't side with anybody. Hopefully, if we're doing our job correctly, the legislature tells us what the law is. The executive branch, you know, is tasked with enforcing that law. And then our job is simply, people often point to Antonin Scalia, Justice of the United States Supreme Court, and had colorfully described what a judge's role is, and as calling balls and strikes in a baseball game. And that's their job. We don't define the strike zone. We don't say what the rules are, but we call balls and strikes. And I'd like to even, you know, expand that a little further. And that is, like, as I mentioned, it's the legislature that tells us what the strike zone is going to be. We're just going to say whether or not the ball is inside that strike zone or outside that strike zone. So, yeah, I think that's, I think in I wish that were the perception that was being portrayed in most media outlets. But so a lot of it is just how we're being portrayed.
Give us a history lesson here, if you will, Mr. Chief Justice. The Supreme Court case of Marbury versus Madison is the seminal case in defining the role of the judicial branch in the United States. First, remind us what that case was about, and second, how it applies to our state.
Sure. A presidential dispute. The sitting in the election of 1800, the sitting president was defeated. And before leaving office, with a very friendly Congress, passed some laws which increased the judicial branch, not only in terms of the number of courts, but also in terms of the number of judicial positions. But the last step to implement that was a requirement that the Secretary of State deliver those commissions to the new judges. And the Secretary of State, being friendly to the outgoing president, decided not to deliver all of those. So that sets up the conflict. And there were really three issues raised. And that is, first off, did the individuals who didn't receive those commissions have a right to sue? The second, you know, could they bring it to the U.S. Supreme Court in the manner that they did? And then the third, could the Secretary of State be compelled to deliver those commissions? And ultimately, what the Supreme Court ruled is that failure to deliver those commissions did, in fact, violate the laws written by Congress, that the appropriate method to enforce that was to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the most memorable part, or the most impactful part of the decision, is the next part, which was that it was the Supreme Court's role to determine whether or not Congress had acted constitutionally. And the U.S. Supreme Court determined that Congress had exceeded what powers were provided to it in Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution, and therefore the law was unconstitutional and couldn't be enforced. And so that's the concept of judicial review. It's the judicial branch's authority to review acts of the legislature to make sure that they're constitutional. Kind of something, though, that gets lost a lot of times is the second part of that, and that is the limitation that's included in Marbury versus Madison. The court was very also quick to recognize that although it has the right to judicial review, it doesn't have the right to legislate. So if it gets a law that's been passed by Congress, it doesn't have any right to or any authority to rewrite it, to change it, or to modify it. Its job is just to pass on its constitutionality.
Let's go back in history a little further.
Okay.
The Declaration of Independence had a large impact on why we have an independent judiciary.
Yeah.
Why was that?
In large part, it was a protection, right? The judicial branch offers checks and balances, and it offers checks against the executive branch exceeding the authority that's granted to it by the legislature. It's a check to make sure that the legislature is following our constitutional provisions and not exceeding its authority. In order to do that, it needs to be independent. It needs to be independent both of the legislative branch and independent of the executive branch. You know, that's the basis of it, that if it's controlled by the executive branch, it's going to do the executive branch's bidding. Same with if it's controlled by the legislature.
Back to present day.
Yeah.
We all have heard claims that trials are rigged, that our courts are being weaponized.
Yep.
What should we here in North Dakota think about when we hear those discussions?
Yeah, and I think it's a concern. But, you know, when I hear that word, having sat on both the trial court bench and now sitting on an appellate court bench, I think this primarily applies to the folks that are litigants as opposed to the court itself. And what I mean by that is, ultimately, the court has no authority to initiate a case. Cases are initiated by parties.
I want to interrupt you.
Yep.
With all due respect.
Yep.
We heard that, though, recently during a trial, that the trial administered by the judiciary was rigged. Continue on, please.
Oh, sure. And I'll get back to rigged, but it's the prosecutor who decides whether or not a charge is going to be brought. And it's also, when we're talking about civil cases, it's individuals who have a right to bring that case. And when I hear the term weaponized, a lot of times what I think of is, in particular in civil cases, where people might be using the process to slow down or delay or just not necessarily a meritful challenge to a law, but simply something to bog down the folks that would fall under that law or like to use that law. I mean, and I'm not sure the context of which the use of the term rigged was. You know, people, lots of people used rigged in different.
I'll be blunt. Yeah. It was our president talking about his recent court conviction.
Okay.
That the trial was rigged.
Yeah.
We hear.
Right. And, you know, I don't know the context of the exact statement. And so it's hard for me to comment on that.
You have challenges, I would guess, in maintaining a fair and independent judiciary here in North Dakota. What challenges bubble up every now and then?
I want to talk first about a potential challenge and something that's very concerning to me. And that is, we've been very fortunate in North Dakota with regard to judicial elections. They are not partisan. And even in states where the claim is that they're not partisan or they're nonpartisan elections, they've become partisan.
More so now than maybe 20, 30 years ago.
Absolutely. But we've avoided that in North Dakota. And the reason why that concerns me is because of the limited number of judicial positions we have in North Dakota, it would be very easy for someone from the outside to influence judicial elections in North Dakota. It would not take exceptional sums of money to do that. That's concerning to me. You know, we look at other states, even, you know, some of our neighboring states, such as Montana, where judicial elections are now exceeding the cost of over $1 million. Obviously, most attorneys in North Dakota are not going to have those resources. Same with recent elections in Wisconsin. They were talking about tens of millions of dollars to run those elections. I don't think that's good for judicial elections. That's not here in North Dakota. I hope it doesn't get here. Another challenge we have in North Dakota is it's the challenge that everyone in every business, every governmental agency, every employer in North Dakota has, and that is a lack of individuals. You know, we have counties now in North Dakota that don't have any attorneys.
Literally
no attorneys.
Why is that?
A number of reasons. One is our population. And as population has shifted out of some of the rural areas, there isn't the people to do that. Some is people not wanting to relocate to rural North Dakota. But it's a challenge everybody faces in North Dakota, even in Fargo, Grand Forks, Bismarck, Minot. Filling positions for any job is hard. And that's, I think, a challenge that North Dakota faces with regard to judicial positions as well. And we've been fortunate. We have a very good, strong trial court bench. But if we continue to see a drop in the number of people interested in those positions, it could certainly impact the North Dakota judiciary.
You and I exchanged some notes before our interview, and I got down to the last question that I had in my notes to you. It's the one you didn't answer.
Yeah.
Why did you want to be a judge, and specifically a Supreme Court justice?
Well, if it's specific to Supreme Court justice, I will tell you one of the things that I discovered even at the district court level. I was fortunate enough to act as presiding judge in the district where I was, and came into contact with the administrative portion of the judicial system. It takes a lot to administer a judicial system. The clerk of court offices, the court administration, the juvenile court, you know, how cases flow through our system, what new technologies we're going to implement, how can we improve, and I call it customer service because it really is. You know, we serve the public. And I like that aspect of it, the budgeting, and the Supreme Court offers that. I also like the Supreme Court. We have an opportunity to look at very defined issues and decide very defined issues. You can do a lot of research. You have a luxury of time on this court that doesn't exist on the district court with regard to how much research you're going to do. And also certainly much more time than you have in private practice to develop those issues.
If we dial it back before you became a justice on the Supreme Court, though, you wanted to be a judge.
That's correct.
Why?
I'm a trial junkie. My private practice was litigation. That's primarily what I did. I did a few other things, but primarily civil and criminal tax litigation. And I like being in the courtroom. And the truth of the matter is trial attorneys don't get in the courtroom that often. Most cases settle. And so being on the trial court bench is the best spot in the world to watch a trial. It really is.
You made a remark where for some, for many maybe, it's a pay cut to be a judge.
It is.
Is that concerning a concern of yours?
That's a concern of mine. You know, one of the things that we want to make sure we do is we have a diverse bench in terms of background. And that includes everyone, private practice attorneys, government attorneys. I will say that some of our best judges in the state are former either government indigent defense counsel or prosecutors, but we can't have a whole bench all of the bench is either former prosecutors or former defense attorneys. We need some folks from private practice. And a lot of folks in private practice, frankly, make a lot more money than you do sitting on a trial court bench.
Is it your perception that all North Dakotans are represented fairly when they have legal issues that come before courts?
I can't tell you 100%. I think I can tell you with confidence that this state provides at the very top of a fair and impartial judicial system. And we track statistics, and additionally, as I pointed out earlier, just the number, the fact that you have a right to appeal just about everything in North Dakota, and very few cases get appealed, lead me at least towards the conclusion, I don't think I can definitively say it is, but leads me towards the conclusion that most people leave our judicial system after encountering it with a belief that they were at least treated fairly and the law was applied correctly. Not everyone, but most people.
Talked earlier about technology.
Yeah.
Give us a taste, Mr. Chief Justice, of what's coming down the road.
Well, I think one nice thing about North Dakota, again, is our size. We can adopt technologies much more rapidly than larger judicial systems. And let me give you an example. When the COVID pandemic started to shut down government offices, and I won't get into it in too much detail, but the state judicial system does not own the courthouses, the counties do. So if a county closes a courthouse, the state court is closed. And as counties started closing their office buildings and courthouses, we needed to adopt. And I'm very proud to say Justice Tufte and Justice Crothers on this court immediately figured out how we could do reliable electronic means hearing. The North Dakota Supreme Court did not miss a single argument. We did not reschedule a single argument. We were able to put those on Zoom and other reliable electronic means and continue to work as a court. Those two individuals, Justice Crothers and Justice Tufte, were very instrumental in helping our district courts also transition to at least a part of their proceedings through reliable electronic means. It was just frankly incredible how flexible and responsive our judicial system was. And a lot of credit goes to our state court administrator, Sally Hollow, as well. But we see, we're going to be adopters of artificial intelligence. Things like court filings, where now we have individuals who are manually going through a checklist to make sure that a filing meets all the requirements. Artificial intelligence can do that, multiple times faster. We can use those individuals to fill other positions. Similarly, we have previously our court rules required the parties to redact private information from documents. That didn't always happen. And we can now start using artificial intelligence to do that pretty effectively and pretty efficiently.
Labor-intensive process.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
If I were to ask you your priorities in the next 2 to 5 years, Mr. Chief Justice, what would you tell me they would be?
First priority would probably be with regard to the municipal courts. They're part of the overall court system, but they're not really part of the state court system. I think getting some more uniformity in our municipal courts. If certain size cities are required to have law-trained judges, but other cities that are smaller in population are not, making sure those judges in the smaller population are professionally trained and have the tools they need to do their job. I think that's one important thing that we need to do. Last legislative session, the legislature tasked us with trying to figure out guardianships and how to help individuals who need care.
Seems to be a problem in every state.
And in this state, we had about 8 different entities that were being funded and there was overlaps, there were gaps. I think that's going to be solved this next legislative session. Our court administration, also Judge Cynthia Phelan from here in Bismarck, have taken the laboring oar to I think, craft some legislation that's actually going to allow us to solve that problem.
Chief Justice John J. Jensen, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for joining us on Main Street.
Coming up, the New York Kammer Musiker returns to North Dakota for its 17th annual North Dakota Winds of Change concerts. Their performances begin August 4th in Lisbon. That's after this.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Apple sauce and some nice red beets.
And we've heard the great music. That means it's only one thing. It's time for Prairie Plates. Rick joins us. How are you, Rick?
I'm doing well, Craig. How are you?
Doing very, very well. This is such a fun time of year. Street fairs are what we're going to talk about today. All of us, or many of us, went to the Fargo Street Fair just a couple weeks ago. And boy, is there a lot of food. And is it ever good?
Yeah, a lot of food, blocks of food, both sides of the street, vendors from cheese curds to oofta tacos to strawberry smoothies.
I got to stop you right there because I saw oofta tacos on your list. You gave me a little cheater note, but I didn't know what oofta tacos were.
Well, it's a fry bread taco and it's loaded with meat, lettuce, tomato, black olives, cheese, and you can put some sour cream and salsa on it.
That sounds really good.
And it really is good, and you probably are going to need a walk after eating that.
That's why you're at a street fair. You can walk around.
Absolutely. But yeah, that's a good thing to get for lunch or dinner. I would highly recommend.
The Fargo Street Fair was so interesting to us. As you turn north on Broadway and walk north a little bit, all of a sudden you're in a major food area. There's kind of food throughout. But boy, it almost looks like a carnival to us. Yeah.
Major food zone ahead. Maybe they should make like big yellow or orange signs.
There is no question what's going on there for sure. Lots of different stuff, lots of good stuff.
A lot of different stuff. There's people that do like fire breathing, fire juggling, different bands, different musical acts, certain things like that. In the evenings, there's different musical acts. I know Thursday evening with the Fargo Street Fair a couple weeks ago, we hung out for a while and listened to this band called Walking Phoenix. So it's not just food and items to buy for your house or your lake cabin. Crafts is what I'm getting at. There's just a lot going on, and it can be a lot of fun.
The thing that I like most about it is that everyone who is there is in a good mood. Hopefully the weather's great. Everyone's outside just really enjoying themselves.
Yeah, and this year the weather was great at the Fargo Street Fair. Sometimes, well, I should say usually, it rains one night or two nights, or the wind blows, and everyone that's been to the Fargo Street Fair or that are familiar with it know about the weather challenges. So this year was really good.
There's a street fair in Grand Forks coming up. You know about that.
Yeah, the Downtown Street Fair in Grand Forks coming up August 23rd and 24th. That's a big one in the state. There will be a lot of food vendors there. I did see some photos about a corn dog stand, so that kind of tips me off that there will be a lot of food options there.
In your notes, I need to tell everyone, it says corn dog. Need to be a foot long. None of these little small things for us, huh, Rick?
No, you need the magnum size corn dog. Yes, foot long. The smaller one will not do. And I like a little bit of mustard on there. I know some people like ketchup and mustard, but there's kind of a rule in Chicago, no ketchup on hot dogs. So I kind of abide by that rule, but a lot of people break it. I'm not going to judge.
I guess. A rule breaker.
Are you?
Yeah, I sure am. I like both ketchup and mustard and relish and onions on my hot dogs.
Well, I mean, a Chicago dog has a ton of stuff on it, so it just doesn't have ketchup. So
okay. I'm 3/4 of the way a Chicago person, maybe.
Yeah, you are. You're getting there. And then in Bismarck coming up here mid-September, September 13th and 14th, there will be their annual Downtowner Street Fair. That's always a popular one, thousands of people. There will be a lot of food vendors there as well. The Downtowners Association does a great job with that. And so I'm looking forward to maybe going to that and checking that out as well, because there will be a lot of food options, and that will be a lot of fun.
Rick, you've been here a long time and I haven't. Have these street fairs evolved over time?
That's a really good question, Craig. And yes, in the beginning it was just kind of crafts and stuff like that, or the beginning of my time in the 80s. It was a lot of crafts and maybe toys for kids, stuff like that. Now it's really grown to where the emphasis is on food. And the food is blocks long, both sides of the street, like I was saying. And they've added in a lot of local bands in the evenings, and that's been really fun to watch. You know, you hear about attendance at the Fargo Street Fair being maybe close to 100,000. I wouldn't doubt that. It gets really busy, but with these new things, it's definitely grown.
Rick, there was a little bit of an elephant in the room from our family about the Fargo Street Fair and safety. And when we went, we really felt safe.
Yeah.
There were police out and about, and we felt that we were in a good place.
Yeah, the Fargo Police Department did a very, very good job this year of boosting security, making sure their presence was known, because last year there was a major threat. And so this year, yes, and kudos to the Fargo Police for working hard, being out there, and making sure people were safe this year.
Are there any indoor street fairs like this in winter time, Rick, that we maybe should be on our radar?
I'm not sure of that. There's some art festivals like at the Plains Art Museum, craft festivals at Drecker Brewhalla, that sort of thing. I don't know if you'd consider that a street fair. Maybe you could. There's some art events like at the Civic Center. I would check the CVB's, FMCVB's website for certain events like that. And those CVBs around the state post those events. So you can check out Grand Forks, Bismarck, Minot, that sort of thing. So
nothing wrong with getting outside, being with friends, and just enjoying yourself at events like this.
No, and and after COVID, I think people really want to get outside when the weather's nice and talk to people, socialize, and food's all a part of that. And I think some of the favorites at the street fair are obviously number one on my list, cheese curds.
I wondered if your list was in favorite order there, and now I'm learning that it might be.
It's in favorite order, yes. Cheese curds, that's number one. I like a little ranch to dip it in. Dip them in gyro sandwiches. You see those from Santa Lucia and Aladdin. Those are very popular. You see the long lines. Corn dogs, we talk about that quite a bit. Foot-long corn dogs, oofta tacos, fry bread tacos. Funnel cakes for dessert, kettle corn, and then some drinks, the fresh squeezed lemonade, and then the strawberry smoothies are quite good too. So
in that list, I have never tried a deep fried Oreo cookie, Rick. And so they were at the Fargo Street Fair, and I never been able to bring myself to order one, but my granddaughter did. So I got a bite of it.
Of course you did.
Yes, I did. And I was surprised. It tasted more like a donut to me than an Oreo, or not even be able to taste the Oreo at all because of the fried stuff. And so it wasn't bad. Will I ever order one myself? Maybe not. Do I hope my grandkids maybe order one or two in the future? Maybe.
That a boy. Yes.
Rick, there's a new restaurant in our state that you want to talk about.
Yeah, this is a little bit off topic from street fair, but there's a Indian restaurant in downtown Bismarck that's quite popular called India Clay Oven. And I go there when I'm in Bismarck probably three times a year. And they just opened a new location north of there up in Minot on Sunday. And it's in the old Bones Barbecue location, 1412 Second Avenue Southwest. For the Minot folks that haven't tried India Clay Oven in Bismarck, I'd go and check it out. If you haven't tried Indian food, it's very good. I love the spices. It's just delicious stuff, and India Clay Oven does a really good job. So we thought we'd mention that this week,
Rick, too. One thing about Indian food that was a little bit surprising to me, because we've heard that they're spicy.
Yeah.
And to me, when I hear that word, that's code for really hot. That's not necessarily the case, though, especially with Indian food.
No, and you can have it at different levels, but you can cook with chilies, too, and take the seeds out just for a little bit of flavor and a little bit of heat. So there are ways to not have, like, the food just blast you.
My son and his wife like the blasting type of food.
Some people do.
And that's just not high on our list, but we do like well-seasoned food, I guess I could say.
I do, too, yes.
Well, Rick, it's a good time to get outside. It's always a pleasure. Rick Guion, he joins us each week on Prairie Plates here on Main Street. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you again, Craig.
Ooh, More food, I mean, more Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
Hey, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily from The New York Times. This show came of age during a tumultuous time in our history, but also at a moment when news consumers were starting to demand digital audio on their own schedule. So The Daily was and still is a very popular podcast, but it's also a radio show. And I'm so pleased to tell you, The Daily now airs weekday evenings at 6:30 p.m. Central. You'll hear reporters from The New York Times talk about the stories they cover and the people at the center of those stories. The Daily is in-depth. You'll have tons of driveway moments and then great conversations once you get home. So join me and my co-host, Sabrina Tavernisi, every weekday at 6:30 p.m. Central on Prairie Public for The Daily.
Welcome back to Main Street on this Wednesday here on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein, pleased to be joined again by Alona Peterson. She's with the New York Camera Musica, and they'll be again performing a series of concerts here in North Dakota, the 17th annual North Dakota set of concerts that they're performing. Alona, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you so much. We're always glad to come back and push our concerts a little bit, but also just let everybody know we're back, for this is our 17th year, and we're only here for 7 days.
Tell me, what sort of music will people hear when they come to listen to your concerts?
This is a very good question, because we're going to have a little bit of anything. Actually, we're going to end it with Anything Goes, the Cole Porter musical arranged for our group. We have several, each year we pick a theme. This year we have 4 themes. We have, of course, Tall the Orangutan in Wahpeton, and this is his 7th annual concert playing with us. Well, what he thinks, it depends what we're playing. He loves Irish music. We were playing in Wahpeton probably 17 years ago, and I noticed Tall at the Hinkabazoo, and he was painting or doing art. He looked very interested in us. So two of us came from my group, and we played for him. They sort of tried not to pay attention. Then I said, let's do something Irish, and sure enough, he came over, sat down, listened to us for 45 minutes. After that, I decided that we were going to get him to blow an instrument. But we had a recorder, that's what it was, and they helped us out. He does rhythm, basically, and he's got very, very good rhythm. So this is how it happened. And then, of course, we had to filter in the group and what would be happening so he didn't get too excited for concerts. So they worked with him after we left. Every day they worked with him, they put out first music stands, so you get used to there would be more people, chairs. The day we performed the first concert with Saul, we came without our instruments, just so he could get to know the whole group. We just walked around. We went and played another concert and came back and was ready to play with us. So that's how it started. I got to tell you a couple of funny jokes, though. Composers all over the world are composing pieces for Tall that we have to play.
Pieces for the orangutan, right? I love it.
Yeah, right, right. I brought a composition by a Brazilian composer, Harold Emmer. I actually gave him the sheet of music. Well, we played it. He ripped it up in tiny, tiny pieces and tucked it under the fence for me. He did not like that contemporary music. We are playing a lot of different music this year. We have 4 themes. We have Tall. We have, of course, the historical 1883 courthouse. We're going to play in the courthouse room that North Dakota was born in, because 1883 courthouse was there before North Dakota. It's where the Dakota territories split up. We'll do music, relating to that a little bit. But also in Jamestown, we're going to be doing some arrangements by our composers of Peggy Lee's music. And I have been hearing from Peggy Lee fans worldwide about this. I hope we can pull this one off with double reeds. All be double reeds. I've got four bassoons and a contrabassoon this year, the low, low instruments. They're going to be doing rhythms that you hear on her recordings, and then the oboes will be doing vocaloid in Minnesota, Detroit Lakes, and Holly. Their theme was German and Norwegian homesteading, and we're going to be doing Scandinavian music, German music. So those are our four themes. Then we're going to try to incorporate this within Renaissance, Baroque, classical, and contemporary music, and probably switch around. We will have bassoon quartets, which is really fun, with the low instruments, and we do have a contrabassoon this year, again. The contrabassoon is the lowest instrument of our group. We're all double reeds.
Ilona, you are a North Dakota native.
I am born in Minot.
What goes through your mind when you come back to North Dakota?
Purposely of doing this, trying to bring our worldwide tours into North Dakota, we got, what comes to my mind is that when I grew up, you know, I just saw Scandinavians pretty much in the area of North Dakota I grew up in. And now the population is changing. But our population in my group, because we've traveled so much, we gain more and more musicians that aren't playing with us. So this year I'm coming with our Japanese bassoonist, a bassoonist from Montreal, an oboist from Canada too. We're one of our oboists is from Washington, D.C., of course, New York City, Las Vegas, and South America. Close to my mind. I don't know. I just, you know, I had my 65th high school reunion, 6 to 5 years since I graduated Central High School, Grand Forks. You know, it's a long time ago, so it's hard to remember exactly. I do remember the population was quite different at that time.
Sure. Ilona, you are the founder and director of the New York Kammer Musiker. What does the word or the name Kammer Musiker, where does it come from? What does it mean?
Well, it's German, sort of. It's not correct German. It means chamber, you know, chamber music, meant to be in chamber, you know, smaller places. A lot of these Baroque and Renaissance composers wrote a lot of music, you know, just to be played in homes. I gotta say, though, just four of us played the large opera house, Sydney Opera House. The stage is bigger than the Metropolitan Opera in New York. I mean, we fit into any space.
I bet that was a thrill.
So chamber, yeah. And then chamber is wonderful to play private homes or any home. I'll be rehearsing in my living room here on Prairiewood. Prairiewood Drive. I think that's why the musicians love to come, because they see space.
Your concerts, Ilona, are free except for admission to the zoo on Zoo Day, but they begin in Lisbon. You've got quite an array of concerts. You're going to be busy.
You're telling me.
I'm going to walk through the list quickly here, Ilona. We are running out of time. Mm-hmm. August 5th in Lisbon at 10:30 in the morning. And then also Monday, mm-hmm. August 5th, you'll be in Fargo. And that will be a preview with a mini concert at the Blue Bar at the Radisson Blue Hotel in downtown Fargo. Tuesday, August 6th, you'll be at the Sons of Norway. That's at 7 o'clock. Wednesday, that's August 7th, you'll be at Holly Senior Living in Holly, Minnesota. Thursday, the 8th, you'll be at the Detroit Lakes Public Library. Friday the 9th, you'll be in Jamestown, 2 p.m. at the Ave Maria, and then at 5 o'clock at the 1883 Stutzman County Historic Site. Saturday, August 10th, you'll be at the Chahinkapa Zoo. That's at 1 o'clock for that concert with Tao, the orangutan. Holy smokes. And on also Saturday at 2:30 p.m. is an outdoor concert in Wahpeton. That'll be at Siena Court. And you'll wind it all up Sunday, August 11th at the First Presbyterian Church here in Fargo. That's at 7 p.m. That's quite a schedule.
It sure is. Yes, it is. For our type of instruments, which require a lot of wind.
Our time is short. Ilona sure. Peterson is a North Dakota-born Norwegian-American oboist and chamber music ensemble director. She's created and directs the New York Kammer Musiker. They are touring once again for the 17th year here in North Dakota. Thank you. Our best wishes to you, Ilona.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
If you really want to know what's going on in this country ahead of the election next year, you've got to get away from the extremes and listen to the middle.
Hi, my name is Venkat. I'm calling you from Atlanta, Georgia.
On my new live national call-in show, The Middle with Jeremy Hobson, we'll elevate the voices of Americans who need to be part of our national conversation.
Hi, Jan, here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Join me every week for The Middle with Jeremy Hobson.
The Middle. Listen Fridays at 3 p.m. Central, 2 Mountain on Prairie Public.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 4 is about sense of humor. It states, Native people have a rich history of shared sense of humor that includes teaching stories involving Iktomi, Maymeguisi, and Nanaboju. These stories and this unique sense of humor continue to support our resiliency and cohesiveness. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll be listening to Leander Russ McDonald, enrolled member of Spirit Lake Nation, in part one of Storytelling and Humor.
Well, we're all storytellers, you know, so I think that, and if you're a good storyteller, you get a little bit popular and people want to hear your stories. I think what happens is that if you can combine humor in with that really well, then you get to have funny stories, and people get to have a good time listening to you, but are able to learn something at the same time. And so I just came from a wake on Sunday night, back at Spirit Lake, and one of our neighbors passed away. And so we went back for that, and an older gentleman got up and shared a little bit, and that's what he did. He shared the story of the life of this lady, and he blended in the different funny, comical pieces of throughout this life that she had in regard to sharing with her, and how that was, how those things were important. And at the same time, while he's talking to the crowd, he's kind of picking different ones up and kind of teasing them a little bit. You know, so you see that happening in regard to that. But we learn through that. I remember when I was kind of getting off the path, and then my folks would sit me down, and they would bring something over there to eat, and a coffee or something. And I knew what was going on. And he would say, I don't think you're going on the right path here. And would talk to me and say maybe you want to consider going to school, or you know, I see you lost your job again, and tell me these things, and stuff that I knew, but stuff that he thought I needed to hear. But he didn't holler at me. He didn't say, what the heck's the matter with you? And he didn't talk to me like that. He said, I just see that you're having some difficulties here, and you might want to rethink things. And so that's how he approached me, in a respectful way. And I was open to hearing what he was sharing with me then.
I'm Scott Simpson. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
That's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow on Main Street, we'll continue our monthly philosophical currents discussions with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. We'll talk about aging. That's coming tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.